If you walked an Oregon beach a couple of years ago, it was pretty clear that the sea stars were not all right. They weren't just dying either. They were wasting away. Sea star wasting disease is about as bad as it sounds. It's a plague that leaves dismembered piles of mush in its wake, and it infected 9 out of 10 animals in some places in 2014. Our guest today is part of a team that studied the impacts of this epidemic and found that recovering from the unprecedented die-off has been explosive. This recovery is detailed in a study published this month in PLOS One, and our guest is a lead author on that study. He's also a leader at the Lubchenco Menge Lab at Oregon State University in Corvallis and joins us now by phone. Dr. Bruce Menge, welcome to The Exchange.
Thank you. Good to be here.
Great to have you here. Learning about this die-off and having witnessed the carnage in 2014, I'm curious how you, as a marine biologist, how did you feel when you visited the beaches while this was going on? Had you ever seen anything like it before?
Not really. Certainly not as extensive as it was. I had seen an event in New England when I was back there some years ago. One site had a lot of animals die off of wasting, but the population recovered almost immediately, and we never saw it anyplace else. So this event was just incredible because we saw it everywhere, and in fact, it occurred everywhere from Alaska down through Baja California along the West Coast, including in the Puget Sound. So it was really an unprecedented event.
And this particular disease, the wasting disease, was it a difficult one to investigate?
Well, it's easy to see the signs of the disease, and so from a scientific standpoint, it was actually pretty easy. But from a personal and aesthetic standpoint, it was pretty depressing. You know, this is an animal that over the decades I've always considered to be one of the toughest there is. They hold onto the rocks very powerfully. They are able to, you know, survive under really severe wave action. You could almost use them as a hammer to pound nails in. They're just really, really tough. And to see this this disease turn them into dried out husks or piles of mush, it was shocking.
Were there any sea stars who exhibited immunity? I mean, I read up to 90% of the members of a population in some places died. Does that ring true to you?
Yes. Some places it was almost 100%.
Wow.
Southern California, I think, there are places where you can't find a single sea star. The devastation was really high. It hit the adults first, so, you know, the most obvious ones, but the juvenile individuals in the population also eventually got sick. It was huge.
And what does it look like? I mean, we know the mush, but how is this a way to die? How do they die?
Well, the most obvious thing is what are called lesions. These are white areas on the upper surface of the animal that form. They can start out as spots or sort of swaths along the animal that is white. That can be associated with the animal shedding arms, losing arms. Holes develop in the body wall. And in the really sick animals, they just gradually, they're unable to hold on to the rock. You know, we have pictures of an animal with 3 or 4 of its 2 feet, the things that they attach to the rock with, basically being all that's holding the animal, keeping it from dropping off the rock. And then the final stage is the disintegration into piles of tissue and their hard parts, which are called ossicles.
We're talking with Dr. Bruce Menge, if you're just joining us. He is of Oregon State University's Lubchenco Menge Marine Lab and lead author on a study about sea star wasting disease. Looking at a particular kind of sea star here, Dr. Menge, the Pisaster ochraceus. for these animals, as they were so affected in 2014, so many of them died, your study found that the orange sea stars were more likely to get sick. Did that have any causation behind it?
Well, no, it turns out that effect was actually fairly minor. The biggest effect was that animals in tide pools were affected the most, at least initially. And that makes sense from the standpoint of animals in tide pools are exposed to water all the time, whereas animals that are out on the rocks away from tide pools are only exposed to water during high tide. So that makes sense in terms of exposure to the pathogen in the water. But the orange versus purple thing, it turned out in a reanalysis, that effect disappeared. Although at one or two sites, it was true that orange animals, at least initially, seemed to be more susceptible.
And the study of this epidemic, which we'll get to the happier news soon about the recovery you've discovered as well, but in the title here, we're looking at the Pisaster ocracius, this very ubiquitous type of sea star, as a keystone predator. And
right.
You've described these guys earlier as the toughest animal there is, pretty much. They are able to eat shelled creatures whole. Can you tell us what a keystone predator is and what other animals were affected by 90 to 100% of them dying off in certain areas 2 years ago?
Well, a keystone predator is a term that was coined by my major professor way back in the 1960s. He was the one who originally studied the predatory impacts of Pisaster. And the idea is, if you think of an arch, the stone at the very top is what keeps an arch from collapsing. And so by allegory, the arch would be the intertidal community, and the stone at the top that keeps it from collapsing is Pisaster, the sea star, because of its predatory activities. Its favorite prey is mussels, but it also will eat most other things that it co-occurs with, barnacles and limpets and snails and all sorts of things.
Could you describe how a sea star eats, just to help me get a better picture of how a sea star could eat a mussel or something
right.
with a hard shell like that?
What they do is they locate a prey and they basically tear it off the rock. So that takes a lot of force. That's why I was saying the animal is so strong. It tears it off the rock and then it basically pulls the shells apart and everts its stomach. So it actually sticks its stomach outside of its body into the mussel and digests the tissue that way. The tissue is then drawn into the mussel tissue is then drawn into the body via ciliary action. And that's how it eats everything. If it finds a limpet, it'll turn it over and expose the foot, and it'll digest it externally like that. So that's what makes it such a great animal to study, is that it actually, the prey, instead of being taken within the body, are actually eaten outside the body. And so you can see them, you can identify them, you can measure them, and so forth.
That's very tough. I mean, I am trying to imagine being hungry enough for my stomach to leave my body and and take something for itself. We're talking with Dr. Bruce Menge of OSU about sea stars and the epidemic that hit them very hard a couple of years ago. They are recovering. We will be talking about that. You can join this discussion at 800-838-3760 or write us an email, jx@jeffnet.org, with your experiences or questions about the sea star wasting epidemic. And if you've seen signs of recovery on beaches since then, we want to hear about it. Dr. Menge, you've described the starfish as the keystone species in this intertidal community, sort of like a keystone and an arch would be. So when so many of them died, what other species were affected, and were you able to study how they're faring a year or 2 years down the road?
Yeah, we've been actually studying that for quite a long time, actually. So we basically are just continuing the work that we started 15, 20 years ago.
Mm.
And what we're seeing so far is there are mussels that are actually moving further down the shore. They're either literally moving, and mussels can move very, very slowly, or they're settling down there and growing up. The biggest change we've seen so far, though, is that there's another prey of the sea star called a gooseneck barnacle. And at several of our study sites, the gooseneck barnacle has settled in unprecedented numbers and survived. So the middle part of the shore and the lower part of the shore at a number of sites are being coated with this barnacle. Now, they are often a precursor to the mussel that the sea stars like to eat the most, precursor to them coming in. So it'll be really interesting to see how things change over the next few years.
Your insights into the population impacts of sea star wasting disease, I want to get to those and ask about causation. I think I have read many things that single out higher water temperature and climate change as a possible trigger for the mass die-off of sea stars. Do you agree with that as a single cause trigger or a main ticket to blame?
Well, there were studies in Washington and Southern California that indicated that the changes were associated with warmer than usual water, but in our work here and along the Oregon coast and also in Northern and Central California, the disease was most rampant when waters were actually cooler to cold because of upwelling. So it's not a simple warmer is the factor that triggers it. It's maybe temperature, but because it's such a widespread event, we're also thinking other factors might be involved, and one factor that is happening, we know is happening, and is steadily worsening, is ocean acidification along the coast. And it may be, for example, that it's some kind of interaction between increasingly acidic water and either warm or cold water. We just don't know yet. We have some studies underway to look at this. I know other people are looking at it as well. So, unfortunately, it's not a simple story, and that's both good and bad. You know, it makes the work more interesting in some ways, but it also makes it more frustrating.
If you're just joining us, we're talking with Dr. Bruce Menge of OSU's Lubchenco Menge Marine Lab. We've been reviewing events of the recent past, just 2 or 3 years ago, when many, many of the sea stars on the whole Pacific coast from Baja all the way up to Alaska perished from something called sea star wasting disease. Dr. Menge, I want to turn now to your field surveys in the wake of this epidemic. Where you studied and what you found to be going on with sea stars after such an unprecedented die-off?
Mm-hmm. Well, what we saw, the most dramatic thing that we saw was last spring, basically the year following the worst part of the disease epidemic, we found literally thousands to hundreds of thousands tiny baby sea stars. So animals that had probably settled in the previous fall of 2014, when they settle, they're only about a millimeter across. They're extremely tiny and hard to see. But by the spring, they were as big as a centimeter to two across. So that would be a half an inch to an inch or so. And they tend to be light colored, so they're relatively easy to see, although you have to really look pretty hard for them. And we have never, in all the time that I've been working in this system, which is since, my PhD work was in the 60s, and then I came back to the West Coast in the 80s, and we've never seen numbers like this ever anywhere. It's just unbelievable.
And are these the offspring of sea stars that wasted away?
Yes, undoubtedly. The Pisaster adults reproduce in the spring. So in spring of 2014, just as the disease was getting underway, was also when they were reproducing. So the eggs and sperm formed into larvae, and they were out in the ocean while the adults were dying off. And then they return after they've matured and are able to settle. They return in late summer and fall. So, yes, they are the products of the animals that died.
And were they spared because, or have they been spared so far because the disease has subsided or because it doesn't affect very young sea stars?
It could be both of those. We have seen small sea stars that have been sick, that are sick, but at a very low rate. You know, less than 5% of the population will be affected. So it's possible that the animals that we're seeing are ones that are more resistant. There may have been higher mortality of the less resistant animals through the winter. The disease is still out there. It's not gone away, but it's at a low, sort of a chronic level rather than a epidemic level.
And is that the historic norm? This is not the first example that we know of sea star wasting disease, but it seems to be the most widespread and epidemic proportion that we've seen. Is that true?
Yes, yeah.
And where is there anywhere that you're looking to see recoveries from perhaps a more cyclical kind of infection where this pathogen is just out there and sometimes it gets a toehold and then it recedes?
Yeah, so in Southern California, during the last two big El Niños in 97-98 and way back in 82-83, they saw die-offs like this of Pisaster. And they eventually recovered through, you know, recruitment, and the disease had receded away. The thing that's different this time is that it's, again, it's latitudinally very widespread. So that's never been seen. That's unusual, and that's one of the things that makes this really interesting. As you say, the pathogen is actually present. It's present in the water column. It's present in sediments. It actually occurs in the bodies of the animals themselves. So what's different is the question, and that's something that we're trying to grapple with, both with respect to the disease agent itself and to the factors that led it to be more virulent.
And you mentioned ocean acidification earlier. Is that a cause of particular interest because it's so widespread that it has to be something affecting the entire Pacific coastline?
Yeah, so the idea is that there may be some threshold pH level that has some effect on the pathogen that's out there that makes it more virulent, or there could be some kind of mutation that happens that low pH triggers. We just don't know yet, and research is ongoing trying to address those kinds of issues.
And are there concerns about the ecological communities affected to have these populations that are recovering, maybe 300 times as many starfish, but they're babies, they're a centimeter big, as you said, and the barnacles have a greater stake in the community now that they don't have adult starfish predating on them. Are we expecting to see more ramifications from having, you know, a multi-generational population die off at once and be replaced completely with babies? I'm thinking about what the human world would look like if that happened, and it's
yeah,
kind of scary.
Yeah, no, there's no question that, for one thing, these small sea stars are still too small to be able to eat the mussels and the gooseneck barnacles and other larger animals that have come in and grown really fast and become very abundant. So it's...
Does anything eat them when they're that small?
The sea stars?
Yeah.
Probably not. They're very cryptic when they're tiny, and they like to crawl into crevices and nooks and crannies and so forth. So if the average person wants to go out and see them, they have to be ready to really get down on their hands and knees and poke around in hidey holes to find them. Once they are big enough and don't have to hide, then they'll become more prominent. But that's going to take a few years.
And this bumper crop of sea star babies, have you ever seen anything like that before, that many juveniles?
No, never.
So is it worth it to poke around in those hidey holes? Is there anything egregious that we're doing to the ecosystem? Or, you know, if a layman, a non-marine biologist, wants to get an eyeful of these baby starfish, anything we should be aware of or concerned about?
No, I don't think there are any issues at all. It doesn't seem as though the disease is transmitted by handling, and as I say, it's at a low level these days. And I think people can still go out and tide pool, and if they want to try to find baby sea stars, they should definitely do it. They're actually quite cute.
I can imagine, yeah.
Yeah, so it's good to it'll be fine.
So how long does this species of starfish tend to live? You know, when it doesn't die of wasting disease.
Well, estimates have been decades.
Wow, decades.
Yeah, animals like this, they're very, as I say, very tough and so forth. And unless disease kills them off, they really have no predators to speak of. You might see the occasional seagull eating one that probably got trapped by rising sand on the shore or something like that. But basically, there's nothing that eats them across at least much of their range. Sea otters will eat them. So where sea otters are located, you might find an effect of higher-level predators. But along our coast and in northern and central, well, northern California, there aren't sea otters, and so they're pretty much immune to being preyed upon. So they live a long time.
And your insights into the epidemic and monitoring of the recovery of juvenile sea stars now, do you make any recommendations in terms of how we can help the sea stars not die off from this wasting disease?
Well, there's really not much you can do. I mean, I've said the only thing we can really do is try to study it and understand it because, you know, the magnitude of the problem is enormous. It's the whole west coast of North America, so there's no mitigation that is reasonable. I mean, one thing that we're interested in is if there are hot and cold spots, populations that for some reason do better versus other ones that do worse. If there are ones that do better, there might be some resistance they have, which would be good to discover. And in fact, there's been some recent work that suggests there may be a gene that's associated with resistance to the disease, so that's being looked into as well.
Sea stars are mysterious creatures, and sounds like this is still in many ways a mysterious death. We've been talking with Dr. Bruce Menge of OSU's Lubchenco Menge Marine Lab about sea star wasting disease and the explosive recovery in certain populations that's happening now. Dr. Menge, thanks so much for joining us on the Jefferson Exchange.
Oh, it was a pleasure. Thank you.